I'd like to introduce our speaker, Alison Beale, whom I've known for some time. She's at the University of Quebec in Montreal, where she's been, I think, quite a driving force in some of the most interesting work that's around there. And what else should I say about you? She'll say most of what she does herself. Let me remind you yet one more time, students, that we want your questionnaires. I have a statement for the faculty this time. By Monday morning, can you have on my desk a maximum of one page, preferably one paragraph, statement of your comments in order to help organize the meeting, and the student questionnaires, if they could also be available by Monday morning, that would also, if you want them to be put formally into the process, they should be in by Monday morning.
Can we have more meetings?
Yeah, you're just beginning. Okay. Can I have a volunteer from among the graduate students to give Alison a ride back to the hotel after this session? We have a small problem with respect to some of it. It has to be among the graduate students. Fine, Anne, that's terrific. That doesn't mean you can't meet, you can. Okay, no problem. Okay, well, Alison, I won't give you a flowery introduction because I've run out of flowery things to say. You can do all the flowery stuff yourself.
Sure.
And welcome to the Department of Communications.
Okay. I think I'll stand up because I found I speak more loudly standing up. Can you hear me? Yeah? I'm also used to speaking in French. This is probably the only time in the last 8 months that I've spoken to a group of people in my native language, so if I have trouble, please forgive me. I thought it would be suitable because I know that you're at the end of a process here, which, by the way, I congratulate you on because it seems to be run extremely well, if not rather exhaustingly, for the candidates. So I know that, for example, perhaps not as many people could be here today and yesterday as was always the case, and I thought it might be helpful for me to talk a little bit before I start about some of the things I have been doing and would like to do, not for very long, but just so that you have some idea of who you're talking to. As Vera said, I've been teaching in the Department of Communications at UQAM in Montreal for the last 6 years. That's my first full-time appointment. I was a graduate student prior to that and taught part-time in various places. I was born in Scotland, grew up in Toronto, and I've lived in Montreal for the last 13 years. So that's the potted biography. What I've been doing mainly has been undergraduate teaching, with a small amount of graduate teaching, because we're overwhelmingly an undergraduate department, and I'm also one of the junior faculty, and if you know anything about departments, you know that we normally get these large undergraduate classes. And I've done a variety of courses in media studies, in introduction to the study of communication, which is our large sort of course that everyone takes who joins the undergraduate program in communication. I've taught several courses on film, a course called Cinéma et Société, and another one on women's film, which I started 4 years ago as part of the Women's Studies program. And this year, because our students wanted one, I started a seminar on video. So since Christmas, I've been running a very enjoyable seminar discussing what is video and what is the specificity of video compared to film and other forms, with students in our department, about 45 of them. And in addition, in terms of teaching, I've done some teaching outside of the BA in communications within another BA that we have called the Social Psychology of Communication, which is more oriented around interpersonal and group communication. And the reason I was there was to give people in that particular area some kind of grounding in media studies, which they have to have as part of their requirement. I've supervised several theses. The ones that I'm working on right now, that they're working on right now, are one on the history of the feminist press in Quebec, which is a most enjoyable project, but has been very demanding in terms of creating a methodology and framework for doing that work. And another thesis on, which is a kind of practical thesis, which is about the decline and fall of a video festival in Montreal that one of my students was supposed to be working on, which got absorbed by a film festival. So we're doing a kind of applied look at arts production, funding, and politicking in a very engaged kind of sense. So those are some of the things that I'm working on right now in the teaching area. This doesn't represent everything that I'm interested in. One of the areas that I haven't been able to teach in for various reasons, having to do both with the fact that some of the work I would want to refer to is only available in English, and also because of the structure of our undergraduate program, which doesn't allow a progression of levels in courses, but puts all those courses at the same level. It doesn't mean that we don't do interesting work, we do, but that is a constraint. So I haven't been able to get very far in trying to integrate another area which I have a long-standing commitment and interest in, and that is history of communication, and in particular, history of communication as oriented around political, economic concepts. This is something that I started working on when I was doing my MA. I wrote a thesis on Innes and his concepts of language. And then I went away to the Center for Contemporary Culture Studies in Birmingham, where I got hit, and I'm glad that I was, with a very rigorous program of coming to terms with Marxist concepts and trying to work with those concepts and dealing in an environment where you couldn't go anywhere unless you could master those. Also an environment in which, when I presented my supervisor-to-be with my MA thesis, he looked at this and said, "Who is this guy?" Well, he wasn't a Marxist, was he? So we didn't manage to ever talk about Harold Innes, which I think is unfortunate, and it is not, by the way, a criticism that I would make of all Marxists, that they couldn't deal with Harold Innes. Some of them have tried to embrace him too closely to their bosom with remarkable lack of success. But anyway, that meant that I encountered another set of principles and interests that I wanted to integrate into this kind of historical, political, economical perspective on communications. And that's what I've been trying to do for the last 7 years, which is why I'm only now completing my doctoral thesis. I have been teaching all the time, but that's no excuse in some people's eyes. So what I plan to talk about now is the work that I've been doing for my doctoral thesis. The title is Communication and the Production of Society. What I wanted to try and do, and what I've been trying to do all these years, is to see how you can do communication history in the light of some of the things that Innes has said, but without going over his texts and reading them once again. I'm trying to define the bias of communication once again. I think that's been done well, but it's been done, and it's time to move on. And so I'm looking for areas where the moving on has actually taken place. Some of this taking place has actually happened before Innes and during Innes, and not only after. So when I say after Innes, all I mean is, where am I going after Innes, or where can we go after Innes? But I'm not implying that there wasn't a great deal of work converging on similar themes to his work before he actually got down to his own work. So I want to start by talking about what I see as some of the major themes in Innes's work, and then I will explain to you where I see other people having worked on those same areas. I don't say taken up. I would say that 90% of the other researchers I'm going to talk about have never heard or had never heard of Harold Innes. This is a convergence on a topic which to me suggests the importance and the legitimacy of the topic if so many people working unconnectedly find a common theme. Well, first of all, the things that you probably are already over familiar with as far as you're concerned. The first problematic that I see as being very essential in this is the conjunction of knowledge, his concept of the monopoly of knowledge, the bias of communication, which is media and media practices, but in specific time and space configurations, And thirdly, the social configurations that are constituted and structured by the ensemble of the monopoly of knowledge and the bias of communication. Various structures come to mind when we're talking about that, the empire, the geographic perspective on communication that is so prevalent in Innes' work. Another thing that you find in Innes that is been of increasing interest, especially to certain kinds of historians since the Second World War, has been the idea that our historical understanding of society is, if you like, a political act or a political gesture in itself. How history is defined and understood is an ongoing practice in society that will always legitimate one way of understanding the present and the past. That's certainly a very strong theme in Innes. And so, therefore, what we're after is as much an understanding of how histories come to be written as an understanding of historical facts and historical times. We have since Innes' time developed another vocabulary for describing some of the functions that he identified, like legitimation and all the work that's been done in alternative history making. The third theme, which is the one that I am probably going to talk the most about today, is the theme that up until the point where I began to do my work, I felt I'd seen the least reference to, but now, in a way, has become an obsession of mine as I trace threads of it interdisciplinarily. And that is that communication is as involved in social production as it is in social reproduction. Now, this is perhaps not a very revolutionary idea, but if you were educated, as I was, in a communications environment in which communication was basically concerned with ideology and the superstructure and culture in a sense that was largely divorced with production. And when I thought about production before I went to Birmingham, I thought of heavy industry because nobody had explained to me what these terms were. And I don't know if I hope you are explaining what these terms are to students here, but I can still talk about production in a class and people think we're going to be taking field trips to factories, which might be a good idea. So I feel very strongly, and I have found many others who feel the same way, that communication is profoundly and over the long haul involved in production and reproduction, and that what was originally a very important theoretical convenience within the Marxist tradition, which was to make this distinction, unfortunately meant that Marxist communication study became top-heavy with concern for the reproductive area, if you follow me. This, in fact, in Innes is much more clearly enunciated in the Staples thesis. When you look at his own histories of communication, somebody pointed out, he actually almost ceases to talk about production. It's implied. He talks about knowledge. He talks about the diffusion of scientific knowledge. He talks about exchange. But he no longer is as directly concerned with what we would think of as production. And that, as yet, is a curiosity to me. I haven't got any sort of advanced thoughts on that particular aspect of his work. And I think this is very important to realize, because when you look at the if you look at the field of communications as a whole, people are realizing, and have been realizing sometimes since the coining of terms like the post-industrial society, that there is an economic value in purely accounting terms to cultural products, to knowledge, to information, and to all the processes that are involved in exchanging these. Nonetheless, this realization has been largely used to distinguish the present from the past. Say, now these things have an economic value which they did not have in the past. And the reason why we must pay so much attention to them now is because they take up such a large slice of the GNP. Well, yes, but that does not preclude the necessity to take a longer term view. In fact, it seems to me to require a longer term view. But I would say, in the main, that longer term view has not been taken. The final point in Innes's work that I find other people trying to deal with in relation to this question of communication history is the question of communication and values. If you look at Jürgen Habermas's work, you have the idea that communication, every communication act, is always striving towards understanding. Okay, we have had this this type of notion has come up in a number of philosophers of communication. And it seems to be implied, at least for a lot of people, it's a very important feature of Innes's work on the Greek tradition. Now, I'm actually not sure that I agree that this is a good interpretation of Innes to say that he finds an ideal communication situation in the Greek tradition. When I wrote my MA thesis, I counted up the number of pages where Innes actually talked about classical Greece and the forum. And there were four pages in the whole book, and the rest of it's devoted to wars, conflicts, which to me is a lot more, which is rather revealing, I think. And I think this question, nonetheless, of the ideal to which all communication is striving is still present. People have an expectation of communication, that it is going to settle accounts, that in the long run, justice will prevail, that what we are doing in communication is by definition asserting some kind of social good. I think you see two sides of this question in Innes and the same kind of ambivalence in other people. You get one perspective which, if you look at the long haul, sees a succession of empires rising, falling, and no notion of progress is implied in these. In another perspective, you get the idea that communicative processes, by definition, are always seeking consensus and seeking some kind of understanding. And I think this question of communication history has to negotiate these two views, these two, if you like, moral views of communication. But as I said, I'm going to mainly concentrate on the third, which is the question of communication and production. Now, one of the advantages of being able to do research in another language, but one of the disadvantages of only being able to do it in one other language is that I have discovered some work in French, which is strongly thematically linked to what Innes was doing, largely within a French Marxist tradition. And also, very interestingly, not taking place in France. This is another instance of the creative margins. The work that's been done at the Grenoble School in France is involved in looking at the social infrastructure as developed by communication. And it's just a kind of a curiosity to me that this was being done in Grenoble or also at the University of Rennes in Normandy and not in Paris where other paradigms are dominant. But two of the scholars in France who have done work on this area are Bernard Miège and Yves Delahaye. You may also know of Armand Matelas, who was at Rennes. Anyway, I was quite surprised when I was browsing to discover this book by Yves Delahaye, which is a collection called Marx and Engels on the Means of Communication. Yves Delahaye unfortunately committed suicide a few years ago, but he left enough essays to be put together in a collection called the Dissonance, which basically enunciates some of the ideas that he was developing. His basic thesis is that the role of communication historically as its most important manifestation in the rise of capitalism. He devotes his study almost entirely to looking at the development of the telegraph and railways and the spreading of the capitalist system in the late 18th and 19th centuries. So that it would be very difficult to get from that some kind of perspective on an even longer term study, but there are elements there. Other people that have been doing this type of work, as I said, were Armand Matelas, Raymond Williams in England, who writes wonderful essays with no footnotes, no bibliography, as I'm sure you've been frustrated by his essays as well, which are wonderful but annoying in this particular way. James Goody, who has revised even his own work in the light of this notion of communication and production and the contribution of knowledge to production. Hannah Hart's book on some of the German sociologists and journalists like Tönnies Schaffel. I don't know if you have read Hannah Hart's book, Four Theories of the Press, which is absolutely, it's like doing the archaeology of communication study. These people were talking at the end of the 19th and in the early 20th century about the ways in which advertising, the telegraph, the improvements in the means of communication were accelerating exchange. That's another theme that I find to be very important in this work, and it's why I'm always coming back to political economy. The factor of exchange is identified by them as being the factor that benefits the most from improvements in communication. So there is this other work going on. Now, I think it's important to understand political economy in two ways. You can do what A. Rothstein does, which is to say that contemporary economics is basically a form of accounting, and that political economy is concerned with the relationships behind the exchange of values. And I don't think there'd be much quarrel with that. But there's always in political economy a kind of striptease going on. You're partly revealing the foundations of the relationships between two parties in any kind of exchange. You're talking about that historically. But if you're Adam Smith, you're going to naturalize those and say, well, exchange is tending towards a system of natural justice, a kind of compromise that we can live with. If you're Karl Marx, you may have another view of the justice in the relationship between parties in exchange. However, what is for me interesting about political economy, and including the classical economists, is that you have a discourse in which you specifically talk about exchange, and you talk about the symbols with which you are exchanging. I mean money, I mean credit, I mean all the forms that we have which represent values. And there is an understanding that these are abstractions based on other kinds of values, however differently you arrive at those values. Now, when you think about Harold Innes, I'm really quite struck by how rarely credit is given to the political economic education which he must have had. He read these books. These are notions that are freely and readily available before we ever get to a discipline called communications, and yet which, by and large, have not been really taken up. So there is actually work going on. There have been philosophers like George Thompson who have written about how the appearance of money helped to develop in Greece the certain kinds of abstraction in philosophy.
Which you Thompson? Get, sorry? Which George Thompson?
I just got George Thompson. I'll look it up for you.
Yeah, no, I know George Thompson. I've seen some of the old issues on Athens.
No, it was about... and the thing about this area of political economy is that it goes on into the present. I think when you talk about the development of the means of exchange and successive changes in the symbols that we use to signify exchange, well then you are bringing it up to date and looking at the installation of banking information systems across the border. You, in other words, you have a longer term perspective which can help you situate some specific developments in the present. And I think this is going to be very important, and I think it is vastly vastly under-researched. Another area or another concept that I would like to talk about now is, I think, a concept for which for me helps to situate communications as a problematic, or as a, specifically as a historical problematic. Raymond Williams developed a term. He made up a term. It doesn't provide footnotes, so I don't know where it comes from. His head. The unresolved range. Communication is about an unresolved range. And you can take this in two senses. He wrote in key words in his definition of communication. This is where this appears. He says, in controversy about communication systems and communication theory, it is often useful to recall the unresolved range of the original noun of action, represented at its extremes by transmit, a one-way process, and share, a common or mutual process. The intermediate senses, make common to many and impart, can be read in either direction, and the choice of direction is often crucial. So he's saying that when we use the word communicate, various things can be implied. But in his investigation of the use of the word communication, which goes back to the 16th century, he finds that the practices are also varied in the same way. In other words, these dual senses don't come from nowhere. They come from different types of communicative practices that have gone on. Anyway, from this I take two points. I take the point that every act of communication implies or a definition of what kind of communication this is. Now, Williams is not the first person to point this out. There are other ways of pointing out the same thing, that every act of communication implies determining the relationship between parties. And is this open-ended? Is this closed? Is this being transmitted? Is it being shared? But so that in every communicative act you have this definition going on. It is not already defined. It is defined in the practice. You can say the same thing about communication in a historical sense. If you take a specific time or a specific place or a specific group of people, you can say that this unresolved range is always in the process of being resolved. And perhaps in the future, or taking a look into the past, you could say, well, the range resolved itself in such a way. But I find this very, very useful for communication, because we're always tripping up on prescriptive definitions of communication, saying communication should be. To me, this is an attractively radical, but at the same time conceptually quite clear idea that every act of communication involves this definition process, and that you can also look at it in a larger social perspective afterwards, so that you have communication almost as a category of activity, and that's the next point that I'm going to want to talk about. I'm sure that you are familiar in the Marxist tradition with the idea of categories, such as relations of exchange, which come to have determining roles at certain points in the economic development of a society. I find it very useful to think of communication in the same way. There is no specific set of practices which is already constituted as communication. We have a concept of what communication is. But communication is going to be materialized in a specific way at a specific time. And it is going to be determinant and determined in a specific way and a specific time. In that sense, it's a category. It's something that you specify within a given historical period, or depending on the range of vision that you are taking. Now the question arises, and it is problematic, because as you can see, I am negotiating, but not entirely within a Marxist problematic. Somebody like Yves de La Haye will say that relations of communication are, he uses the word parasitic, they're parasitic upon exchange relations, or they're, in other words, parasitic upon other power relations in the society, between members of that society. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with this. I think that at certain times, relations of communication are going to determine what other kinds of social relations are possible. So that you have to perhaps open up a category for communication which does not make it secondary to some existing category within the Marxist paradigm. There is, I think, some other work here that's important to underline with relationship to the concept of the unresolved range, this open-ended process that I want to keep available. It is true that means of communication, from the simplest physical forms of language to the most advanced form of communication technology, are themselves always socially and materially produced, and of course reproduced. Yet they are not only forms, but means of production, since communication and its material means are intrinsic to all distinctively human forms of labor and social organization, thus constituting indispensable elements both of the productive forces and of the social relations of production. Moreover, the means of communication, both as produced and as means of production, are directly subject to historical development. This is so because the means of communication have a specific productive history, which is always more or less directly related to general historical phases of productive and technical capacity. And there, Williams introduces the slight elision that I think you have to maintain between the development of means of communication and the mode of production in general. And secondly, he says, because historically changing means of communication have historically variable relations to the general complex of productive forces and to the general social relationships which are produced by them and which the general productive forces both produce and reproduce, etc., etc. So there is, in fact, a fairly elaborate effort on Williams's part to lay some of this out. But it all takes place in this one essay, and I have not come across any other work of his that really takes that ball much further. Now, to get a slightly different perspective on the same theme, if you look at Yves de La Haye, you will get this much more concentrated vision of communication history within the rise of capitalism that I referred to earlier, and which is more difficult to integrate into a longer term sort of history. He says, if we tentatively include within the communication question the vast ensemble which concerns the study of the material transportation infrastructures, roads, ports, railroads, you can see why I think that Grenoble is a Canadian city. The means of locomotion, steam engines, steamships, and locomotives, which favored passenger travel and the conveyance of commodities, and finally, the instruments for transmitting information which accelerated the diffusion of messages and increased their importance, we can sum up the materialist formulation in a single phrase. The communication question can only be understood in terms of the relation between production and circulation, he says. Marx and Engels, themselves living in the early years of the railroad, the early application of the steam engine to land and sea locomotion, and the first stammerings of the telegraph, examined these inventions in terms of the movement which capital traced in its merchant and then later industrial forms in the 16th and 17th centuries. So he's laying down the groundwork for basically exploring and defending the importance of communications within the development of capitalism. But you then do have a problem, how to treat communication more generally in a historical perspective. And I think that there is not a resolution of this dilemma, if you like. I personally like the idea of communication as a category of activity that gives you something substantial to work with. It also forces you to relate the means, the practices of communication to the mode of production in society, and very much along the lines, in fact, of the old style Canadian political economy, which is what Innes was to start with. But there is another element here, which is, I think, understated by Deleuze, whereas it's probably overstated by other Marxists, and that is the question of the production of knowledge and the production of consciousness. I think that in relation to social production in general, someone like Innes or Williams is much more successful at integrating the factors of language, of knowledge, of the use of symbols into a historical perspective than is Deleuze, because at a certain point he forces himself to abandon, and this is a problem in Marxism, abandon a kind of anthropological view and to substitute that with a version of history which situates the determinants outside of consciousness. Now, there are other Marxists who obviously have turned that around, but he is not one of them. And within this investigation of communication history, I think Williams, although I do wish he would produce some more on the topic, is probably our best bet. Let me just mention some other research which is not specifically described or self-described as communication history, and which nevertheless I feel takes on some of the same combination of factors that I've been trying to get at. This would be in the area of the history of literacy. I'm sure that you know already the work of James Goody, some of the collections by Harvey Graff that have been produced on literacy. Work done by also Elizabeth Eisenstein's book on the printing press, which you must have come across. And also an American, a Californian historian, Natalie Zeman Davis, who's done work on the history of literacy and specifically on early modern France. The sum of this work, if I can throw it all together briefly, is to say that our McLuhanite perceptions about changes in consciousness brought about by writing and by printing are, to say the least, exaggerated. And in fact, we have to look at this process much, much more, in much, much more complexly and completely. But that's not all. We don't just get that kind of sweeping McLuhanite statement replaced by a hodgepodge. There are some specific themes that come out in this research and which, to me, correspond to some Innesian themes. Elizabeth Eisenstein, in her introduction to her book on the printing press, defends her methodology as being one which is basically concerned with the diffusion of knowledge among an elite group, that is a literate and scientific and philosophical elite in early modern Europe, concentrating on France. And the reason why she says this is a fair way of going about judging the effectiveness of the printing press is because she says these are the people who used print, who exchanged information, and who were in positions where they could affect social change. That is, I hope, a fair summary of how she describes her methodology. So she doesn't feel obliged, for example, to try and go and look at how the whole society, every member of the society, if it were possible to recuperate that, related to print culture. But she does imply a theory of the diffusion of knowledge within her book, which is important. I think you have to have some kind of concept of knowledge and a monopoly of knowledge, which is basically what she's talking about, in order to be able to look at determining factors at all. But Natalie Zeman Davis does something quite different. She looks at users of books frequently in villages by going through parish records and various traces that have been left behind, and discovering how many people would have used the same book, or discovering, for example, that contrary to what we tend to think, a lot more women were both readers and writers in the early modern period than we imagine. She has an interesting expression. She calls books carriers of relationships. But she's very careful to specify that she's not talking about some kind of textually derived notion of the audience that we might have today. She actually describes the relationships between borrowers, lenders, readers, talkers, people who would have read aloud within a group to other people. And that the book, therefore, is almost a center of activity, which generates a variety, permits a variety of different types of communicative relationships to exist. She also says that there is a very interesting difference between what the small scale geographical space that she's working in or concentrating on, and what Elizabeth Eisenstein is basically dealing with, an elite that could communicate over distance much more easily and could exchange ideas and knowledge over distance. And I don't propose to declare myself in favor of either of these approaches. There are yet other approaches, but all I wanted to do was to point out to you some of the ways in which this work was being done, and which takes up themes and problems of methodological problems in communication research, which we think perhaps are exclusive to our own properly named field. I'm going to talk a little bit now about the notion of practice or practice. The reason why I want to talk about this is because I think that when we are doing communication history, the first thing that tends to be forgotten is that the people whose traces we're looking at and the societies that we're trying to recuperate were practicing. And I see an analogy between this and another area that I've been very involved in, which actually is feminist film theory and practice. And if you permit me to digress, I'll come back to the relationship between these. It was suggested in the mid-1970s that one might be able, taking one film, to be able to produce a number of interpretations or meanings. And a number of filmmakers actually tried to include audiences and subjects in the work that they were doing in order to make the filmmaking process not simply a passive receiving one, but one in which knowledge was actually generated and ideas were formed. To my mind, that type of practice and that idea has gotten somewhat lost in the shuffle in the domination of the psychoanalytic perspective, certainly within feminist film theory. Nonetheless, I am now going to make ad hominem or ad feminine comments. I have seen the new knowledge generated as a consequence of film production and discussion. It can happen. So, in other words, there is a great deal of confirmation within the field of cultural production that communication is a praxis and not a process. It is something in which one can intervene. And I think one of the difficulties in doing communication history is that you constantly have to keep this variable in mind. You only have traces of practice. You don't see the practices going on. And I think when you end up describing human or social development as being determined by means of communication or being determined by specific media, you tend to forget that this is, I certainly think, in Innes's original intention anyway. They were determined by practices, determined by a means and a practice, and not simply by the means. And it is the practice that tends to get left aside. We also tend, I think, to use praxis, and it has been used deliberately, ideologically, to compare or to contrast alternative communicative or cultural practice with mainstream communicative practice, whatever that might happen to be, those forces that we are all submitted to. And I think then we lose the sense that, for example, what goes on at the Bank of Canada, or what goes on in Ottawa, or what goes on at the Senate of the University of, or at Simon Fraser University, is a communicative practice. It doesn't just appear, and it's not just constituted. So it's that is another feature of the work that I've been doing. That I've been trying to hang on to. Just to conclude, and then I'll be very interested in answering any questions that you might have. I'm trying to develop a notion of communication as a category, which we can specify in terms of means and of practices in any given historical or social instance, and whose determining or affective role also has to be specified. It cannot be taken for granted. I think that there are elements which have to be put together in order to get a coherent view. You have to understand how knowledge is produced and generated in these circumstances, and that brings us back to the monopoly of knowledge. You have to understand how exchange is facilitated and how that relates to the economic and productive relationships between people. And I think ultimately you have to, and this is open-ended, you have to attempt to see the relationship between this communicative practice and the mode of production, the social mode of production as a whole. And basically all I'm trying in my thesis is to explore this area, insisting very much on the concept of monopoly of knowledge and the exchanges of information and of values which are implicated in that.
Over to you. Martin.
There's a number of questions, so I'll ask the one that I probably know least in that. And that is your discussion of feminist film theory.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a suggestion, were you suggesting, and I know it was a comment in passing, a way that you are working towards recuperating the audience, that kind of analysis?
Sorry.
In other words, that you suggested that since a particular period of time, the audience is not constituted a focus of study, the subject itself. And that this is because of certain privileging psychoanalytic approaches. Are you looking in your own, in this analysis or your work that's related to film studies, to bring an audience perspective back into?
Well, I don't think the audience perspective has disappeared. I just think it's taken on a different form. It's an abstract and individual audience that
situation,
yeah,
subject.
That's right. Which is one thing that ought to be looked at. But what I was thinking of actually were some specific filmmaking practices that I was familiar with when I was in England. The Independent Filmmakers Association around between 1978 and 1980 produced a series of films in conjunction with various groups. Can't describe them in terms of any sort of given set of social roles, but with a variety of groups. of people and doing things like taking films, taking rough cuts back to the subject and having them look at the material and discuss it. Regarding the discussion that follows the film screening, as equally important as the actual film itself, regarding the knowledge that's being produced by a certain film as going on and on, but in specific practices, not abstractly, but the idea that you could intervene in this process of generating knowledge and understanding, you could set it up so that people could discuss. You could set it up. You're working on a media literacy project. You know, if you take enough time, you can explain to most people the essential features of how images are created and can distort in any given production, and then you can get into much more interesting and complex things after that. Yeah.
How did you work to form the documentary you're making on
Oh, gosh. You better explain what it is you're
yes,
doing.
Yes, I think I forgot to mention when I began that I have been working on a documentary broadcast on Harold Innes, which I'm doing in conjunction with the Télé-Université de Québec in a French version first, and then we're doing the English version, which is interesting since all the taped interviews are in English. Actually, that's a wonderful question, and I wish I could say that everything I've learned about film theory and practice is going right into this highly original and creative product. We are also determined by, for example, the money. money will get you every time. That's one feature. The other is that because of the educational slot that we're fitting into, the possibility of doing experimental things like having a ghostly Harold Innes appear and try and negotiate his subjectivity is rather problematic. No matter how one would like to do it. So this thing actually has a fairly standard format, except that we are using biography, and I'm using voice-off readings from letters and diaries, using a chronological approach, because he got interested in various things at various stages of his life, and they were very strongly reflected in his private correspondence. And so we're cutting back and forth between exposition, voiceover, an interview in this particular format. But I certainly asked myself a lot of questions. I'm almost glad to have had the constraints imposed, because when you've been a theoretician all your life, the choices seem infinite. Yeah.
Bill.
I wonder if you could explain to me where you see some sort of connections with this, your work in terms of communication as production,
mm-hmm.
with public policy issues that are current in Canada. I know that Williams touches on them a little bit in the same sort of area. I wonder where your direction would take you.
That's a very good question. One of the things I have thought about, although I haven't done personally work on it, I think that Rhianne
McMahon
has worked on this, is the relationship between interest groups in Canadian society and the formation of policy. And I would see, I think you could possibly, in one perspective anyway, see policy as an articulation of an interest, and that this comes out of communicative processes in relation to the whole productive structure of society. I mean, the questions of ownership and control, questions of class, questions of region are involved in that. That doesn't nullify the interest in intervening in policy to say that it is an expression of those things. Quite the contrary. But I think you have to work with policy fully cognizant of the interest that it represents. It's not a It may be a specialized practice, but it's nonetheless related to these other elements.
Can I add to that?
Sure.
Let me follow up on it. That's sort of in terms of general policy,
mm-hmm.
how policy is done in general. Mm-hmm. What about some of the more specific things that we might call communication policy in Canada?
Well, like?
Broadcasting, like in terms of new technologies.
Well, I think if you were to look at the development of the communication infrastructure in the country, which is ongoing, which is part of what you're talking about, then again, you would see that as an expression of political and economic interests, and it may be mediated in various ways, but that's essentially what it is. And then, of course, when you set up networks, you determine other outcomes, and so that alters the shift. But I mean, I suppose one could try and think of a specific example. If you have a decision or any kind in mind, or a...
No, I just wanted to. I think that the first part of your question sort of answered
yeah.
the general thrust.
Can I throw a question first time? None of you. I know you're doing some work on video.
Yes.
As a particular research study. I'd like to hear a little more about that, and it didn't come up as part of what you laid out, mm-hmm. so I think it might be useful for other people to know what you do.
That's right. I think I talked about my teaching, but I forgot about my other research projects, which are the film on NS and a project that I'm doing in Montreal on Montreal video. I'm also teaching a seminar in video, but that's separate. This project is one that I'm doing in conjunction with four video producing and distributing groups in the city, which are the major ones: Prime Video, Videograph, Co-op Video, and GIF, which is the Groupe d'Intervention Video. And they were basically interested. This is an interesting instance of generation of new knowledge. I invited several of these people to come and talk in a seminar at the university. And they began talking about their financing and coordinating difficulties. And afterwards they said, gee, thanks, you know, we never get together and talk about these things. We think that we know what our problems are, but we don't really know what our problems are. And then the possibility came up of doing a study. So what essentially we're doing is a financial assessment of these groups, their funding sources, where there are overlaps among them, which is a very touchy thing to be going into, because you don't want to suggest that they rationalize their activities. You can present the results and they can decide what to do with them. The reason for this was, I suppose, with the idea of promoting video and getting more of it seen. There's a big move to try and get more video time on various cable television networks, which I think is a feature across the country in terms of video. And the other question that has come up is the question of a video documentation center, because we have the Cinémathèque in Montreal, but we don't have a specific center for the study of video, whether in aesthetic or cultural industry terms. So that might be a second step if we carry on with it. But for the short term, what we're doing is doing this assessment, taking it back to the people that we designed the project with, having a public forum in May, and then submitting a final report, and they can lobby, throw it in the garbage, do whatever they want with it at that point, or if we decide to, we might go on and do another step in the research.
Is it producers of video art? Is it video art?
Well, I don't know if you know the Videograph in Montreal, which is doing more and more video art because there is less and less documentary and intervention being done. I mean, this is a territorial battle. Prim Video, which is the main art video, I love these labels, but we have to use them. The main art video producer in the city recently handed over all its distribution to the Videograph, because the Videograph is the biggest and it's been there the longest in it. This is a rationalization of activity. So no, it is, theoretically, it's both kinds, but as you know, most of the production that's being done is in what you could call art video.
Yeah,
And I mean, there
we
are other.
Just reverse the terms here, video art. Video art. We have a video in here as well, which is a big
aspect.
Right.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that would be something I'd be very interested in doing if I came here, or even if I didn't, would be to try and enlarge the perspective. One of the things I mentioned to a couple of people yesterday that I think is interesting about this question on video, and maybe it's more pertinent to Quebec than it is to British Columbia, is that always in Quebec, cultural policy has been a provincial or provincial versus federal question. And the city does not exist. The city conceptually is a vacuum. There was no, neither in theory nor in practice, was the city an important site for cultural development, except for in Montreal, sort of bread and circus sorts of things. Now we have a new city government, although I think the city government is the outcome rather than the creator of a different civic sense. But obviously cities are sites of cultural production which allow relationships between people, which, you know, this provincial and federal provincial concept really was not able to deal with. And you get people underfunded because they have to have a, you know, there has to be a video center in Chibougamau, whether or not anybody wants to see video in Chibougamau. So you've got, you know, underfunded people in Montreal living on welfare and doing exciting work. So, well, the point of that was to say that it's very interesting to try, and I don't know whether you've been doing that in your policy work here, look at cultural production in terms of the city and the city factor. It's not a popular thing to talk about in Canada, but it's
neither a federal nor a municipal nor a city. Tony, you're on.
Okay, I'd like to come back to Mark's question about the relationship between the film and the audience, which is the recuperation of the audience, the relationship between. You talk about Williams, transmit and share to kinds of communication. So, assuming that we have, that you could actually see this, a feminist film, this existed, and feminist film.